Welcome to the inaugural episode of Derm Discussions. If you're a dermatologist, you have likely dealt with conditions related to skin pigmentation and inflammation. Besides the obvious physical and clinical burdens that need to be addressed, these conditions can also have an impact on patients' social, mental, and emotional health. And the treatment and therapies may not always be so straightforward, or they may need further development. People of color are a patient population that especially face disparities and clinical challenges when dealing with these often untreatable conditions. There is a growing recognition within the field of dermatology that work must be done to address this unmet need and provide optimal care for all patients, regardless of race or skin color. In this episode, Dr. Brad Glick had the opportunity to chat with board-certified dermatologist Simal Desai about the impact of various skin pigmentation conditions, including vitiligo, post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, seborrheic dermatitis, and melasma. They discussed the challenges of treatment and management within people of color populations, as well as strategies to overcome them. Dr. Desai shared his experiences and best practices when working with people of color and touched on the future of care for some of these skin conditions. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome to Derm Discussions, the new monthly expert-led dermatology podcast series from HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Brad Glick, and I'm a board-certified dermatologist and clinical assistant professor of dermatology at the FIU Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine in Miami, Florida. Our topic today is what's new in skin of color. Joining me today is Dr. Simal Desai. Dr. Desai is a diplomat at the American Board of Dermatology and a board-certified dermatologist. He graduated from the Morehouse College of Medicine, receiving his MD degree, magna cum laude. He is the founder and medical director of Innovative Dermatology, a state-of-the-art private dermatology practice in Plano, Texas. He also serves as clinical assistant professor of dermatology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Dr. Desai is author of numerous publications and has been invited to present at congresses internationally. He is world-renowned in his expertise in the field of skin of color, pigmentary disorders, including vitiligo and melasma, psoriasis, acne, and cosmeceuticals. Dr. Desai also conducts numerous clinical research trials in his private practice. In 2017, Dr. Desai was appointed to serve on the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's Pharmacy Compounding Advisory Committee and is the only dermatologist serving on this important hearing committee. Dr. Desai currently serves on the board of directors of the American Academy of Dermatology and is the immediate past president of the Skin of Color Society. I must say that we are honored, Dr. Desai, that you are here today as our first speaker for Derm Discussions, this new podcast. So welcome and thank you so much for being here.
Brad, thank you so much for having me. This is exciting to have a new forum to talk about everything new and hot in our specialty. So thanks for the invitation.
I couldn't agree more. Let me just start with a data point. So by 2045, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, non-Hispanic whites will no longer constitute the majority of the U.S. population. I really think it's important, Simal, that we look very carefully at all of our patients, and I think particularly as this states moving forward with our patients with skin of color. One other comment before we get into the questions is one of our colleagues who is also an expert, like yourself, in skin of color recently said, and that's Candace Heath, said our knowledge base and approach and treatment of individuals of color should be standard of care. And I couldn't agree more with that statement. What do you think?
Well, you know, I agree, Brad. And I think this is a twofold discussion. You know, we have so much interest in our specialty right now in skin of color dermatology and in diversity and in health disparities. And that's fantastic to have the opportunity to have that discussion and that dialogue. But treating patients of color and understanding skin disease and skin of color is part of what we do every day as board certified dermatologists. So there really doesn't need to be a whole separate carved out discussion. The reason we're having these discussions is because this is an unmet need and we need to continue to delve into this more. But I agree with you. We are the true and only experts in hair, skin, and nail.
What are the challenges in caring for these patients, particularly those individuals of color?
So vitiligo, Brad, as you mentioned, is an extremely devastating and difficult condition to treat. What's difficult, because we still don't know the exact etiologic cause. We're making lots of progress in the science and the molecular mechanisms of vitiligo. But we don't have a cure, and believe it or not, we have zero FDA-approved treatments for vitiligo. As with so many skin diseases, there are no FDA-approved treatments for vitiligo. Actually, vitiligo is the reason I became a dermatologist, specializing in pigmentation and skin of color, is because of my own younger brother's experience with dealing with vitiligo and my family's experience dealing with this at a very young age, and seeing the impact on a family of Southeast Asian Indian background, and how vitiligo was really viewed as a social death sentence, if you will, ostracizing from many socioeconomic factors, culturally stigmatizing in many parts of the world, including my native India, where my parents are from. And people who have vitiligo, children who get vitiligo, are oftentimes given up for adoption, thrown out of their families. There's still such a lack of understanding that this is not a contagious skin disease, but it is a medical skin condition, and there's so many sequelae. So I think the broader message for me whenever I'm dealing with vitiligo in my pigment practice is giving my patients hope and empowering my patients that it's okay to feel bad about your condition, because society has made you feel bad in probably so many aspects. The stairs when you're at a mall, you know, feeling uncomfortable in relationships, job interviews where you're worried about hiding your hands and not shaking hands with someone because you're concerned they're going to see splotchiness on your skin. And these patients of color experience this so much more. So your point is well taken. And I think from a treatment perspective, we continue to make advances. And there's lots of hope and excitement on the horizon, both from a clinical research trial and from a basic science. But there's still more we have to do.
Let me ask you this, just briefly. What is your initial workup for these patients? And maybe just tell us a couple of the therapies that are coming, because we really haven't had very much topical corticosteroids, topical calcium urine inhibitors, and excimer laser. So what else is out there? What do you do for these patients in terms of workup, and what are the therapies you offer them?
Well, I agree. I think topical therapies, phototherapy, antioxidants are all a huge part of my therapeutic armamentarium. And I will tell you that vitiligo, in my opinion, is not a monotherapy disease. You really have to customize a regimen with multiple aspects of both topical systemic modalities. I use a lot of systemic steroids, oral mini pulse systemic steroids, dexamethasone therapy that many people have heard me talk about on podium and in literature, 4 milligrams on Saturday, 4 milligrams on Sunday. Doing this for 8 to 12 weeks to help stabilize the condition is helpful. JAK inhibitors, or the Janus kinase families, are drugs are really exciting because we're seeing helpful results with that. I use a lot of compounded off-label topical and oral tofacitinib topically in 2% formulations, but I actually prefer ruxolitinib cream, which is 1.5%, and find that actually works better. Of course, this is expensive and off-label, so you have to counsel your patients on that. One of the things I think I try to do on the first vitiligo visit is really try to classify my patient very succinctly on visit number one as, are they unstable or are they stable? Meaning, are they getting worse with spreading more than 1% of their own BSA or the palm of their hand in 1 month? Or are they going to become more of a stable patient, which is the most common patients who are the ones that are stable in their therapy. And those are the ones who respond best to other things, including surgical modalities. So identifying these patients, I think, is really important.
I think we're going to get ruxolitinib actually fairly soon, not for vitiligo, but I think in psoriasis. So for those of us in dermatology, yeah. One of the things I love about being a dermatologist is being an artist, and we can be artistic with our new therapies. Let's talk about something else. What about post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation? The management of this entity is so important in general, and particularly in our patients of color. What are your recommendations and your practice principles for PIH, and maybe even use a disease state example like acne, where there's a lot of post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation and a lot of frustration on the part of our patients, particularly those with skin of color?
You know, I would say that there is there's a lot of lack of understanding from our patients that post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation happens because of a skin condition. So in order to treat the PIH, you always have to take a step back and treat the underlying condition that caused the PAH first. So I have a patient who comes in with acne. I see this with my skin of color patients every day. They've got acne and PIH. Those patients are more worried about the PIH than they are the actual acne bumps that are sitting on the face. So I have to kind of level set and say, I've got to get your cystic acne treated first before I can go chasing your pigment. Otherwise, we're just going to be going in circles. And so I think that is one important part of our therapeutic ladder when it comes to treating our patients with PIH. I think the other thing about PIH that we are continuing starting to address is that in PIH, we still need to understand more about how much active inflammatory mediators are still in the skin. So we know that it's caused by leukotrienes and prostaglandins that then cause damage to the basal layer of the epidermal dermal junction, causing pigment to drop down into the dermis and creating these melanophages. But is there a way to address that inflammatory cytokine production even earlier on so you can mitigate PIH from the underlying disease? So I actually think PIH to me is really exciting. And a lot of times, you know, I've coined the term on podium before, intra-inflammatory hyperpigmentation instead of post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, because I find that the inflammation is still going on even when you see someone with PIH. It's not just a one phase thing. This is a constant cycle, as you know.
A number of patients come into my clinic and they say, well, I'm here for an acne visit. And their acne is essentially resolved. And they think that their acne is still persistent in early and early inflammatory hyperpigmentation. For my optics, I maintain their acne regimen, but then of course we can sprinkle in some other therapeutics, perhaps to move along that PIH. Any suggestions in terms of additions once they're a little further along in their response to therapy, using acne as an example?
You know, I completely agree. So some of those patients with skin of color, what I like to do is make sure that these patients we treat not only with antibiotics and topical retinoids. And by the way, retinoids are a huge component of my PIH treatment algorithm because retinoids are anti-inflammatory and also, of course, a comedolytic and lots of other things in acne. But also incorporate things like azelaic acid. Incorporate things like topical tranexamic acid. Incorporate things like, if you can get some of those ingredients on earlier, you may have a patient who may not need hydroquinone. And that's something that helps us to know really how we're moving into this space. So I think that's huge.
Last question in this area and we'll move on. Do you compound products frequently?
I compound products all the time.
Talk to me about seborrheic dermatitis, particularly in skin of color. I find seborrheic dermatitis sometimes challenging in general, no matter what the skin. I think there's sometimes a challenge, particularly in skin of color, when we consider differential diagnosis. Not all that looks like seborrheic dermatitis is seborrheic dermatitis, and vice versa.
I completely agree with you, Brad, that seborrheic dermatitis can be challenging because it is a condition that can have many different morphologies, especially related to making sure that the patients know that it just isn't itchy and red and scaly. I've had many patients with skin of color that don't even know they have seborrheic dermatitis because guess what? It looks like it has PIH. And a patient today, perinasal area acne patient, and said, oh, I never had acne bumps here, but I've got dark spots. Well, guess what? If you lightly scrape those dark spots, you can actually see scale, similar to scraping someone with tinea versicolor. I know that sounds very sort of banal and not very intuitive, but it actually is true. The other thing that I find is that in patients with seborrheic dermatitis, don't forget to look at the central chest. Don't forget to look behind the ears, the back of the neck, and even the sort of anterior axillary vault. SIBO psoriasis is very common in patients of color, and petaloid seborrheic dermatitis that can even mimic psoriasis in some cases is very common. And in patients of color, you don't always see the micaceous silvery scale. So that's very, very common.
Give me your common treatment regimens when you're approaching an individual of color where seborrheic dermatitis is concerned.
So I love to use anti-inflammatories. For example, I really like to use products that not only helped with the Malassezia or the yeast component, like the azoles, and particularly ketoconazole and sodium sulfacetamide as a cleanser wash combo. In fact, I always tell my patients, take the shampoo and use it as a wash. But I also like using some of my non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, tacrolimus and permacrolimus. I really like those. In fact, my patients with skin of color, they actually sometimes prefer the ointment, especially if I'm dealing with seborrheic dermatitis in the hairline. Those patients find the ointments very moisturizing for their hair. We know that many of our ethnic patients have more coarser, brittle hair. The ointments are actually nice for those patients. Whereas a patient with non-coarser, brittle hair, but that hair is still dry, I may like more oil-based emulsions, like a fluocinolone oil. I love using that for my patients. And I like that in more of the steroidal group. So I really like to mix and match. But I think, again, seborrheic dermatitis to me is not as simple as we think. And I'm glad you asked about it, because it can be complicated. And most importantly, it's chronic. So it's chronic, meaning our patients are still going to be bothered by it. So I encourage a multimodal approach, a zinc, pyrithione, azole, sodium sulfacetamide in terms of cleansing, toning. And then finally, using non-steroidal anti-inflammatories as well.
Very similar for me as well, too. And I'm glad you brought up the topical sodium sulfacetamide. I use that quite frequently, particularly in my patients of color, and it's quite helpful. Last topic, Dr. Desai, melasma, very challenging condition to treat. One of the most challenging I face, in my opinion, on a day-to-day basis, sometimes frustrated patients, particularly those individuals of color. What are your strategies for managing these patients, and what are some of the newer and emerging therapies you can tell us about?
So some of the exciting things of melasma, in my opinion, really revolve around understanding the vascular component of melasma is a huge part of the pathogenesis and the manifestation of the disease, and also new advances in our understanding and uses of tranexamic acid, and also some new ingredients such as Rumex occidentalis and cysteamine. Those are some of the new ingredients. And I think where we're headed in melasma is trying to get away from a hydroquinone focus and using more of a non-hydroquinone-based approach. And that's what excites me the most, is keeping my hydroquinone as my topical gold standard for when I need my big guns to come out or when I have a flare, and then using my natural and non-hydroquinone-grade ingredients to just maintain and keep that disease under control. And remember, melasma is a chronic disease. It is not ever going to go away 100%. It may look gone, but it's always lurking in the background. And that's been shown on brown channel imaging in multiple studies, on meximeter density analysis, where clinically the patient is better, they're happy, and then they go to the pool or a pool party for an hour with no sunscreen, and then within 2 days, the pigment's back. And we've all seen those cases. You live in South Florida, Brad. You probably see this all the time. In Dallas, we see it all the time in 100-degree summers. So lots of more understanding that I'm really excited about for melasma.
Well, I really appreciate that. I mean, this has been a tremendous 30 minutes for me. I always appreciate conversing with you, and it's obvious to me in spending this time with you why you are such an international expert on pigmentary disturbances and certainly vitiligo and all the matters that we talk about today. And I think they're very important matters, particularly in individuals of color. There's more to come. I really appreciate your time today, and I look forward to reeling you in some other time soon on another subject matter on Derm Discussion. So thank you so much for your time. I know how busy you are, and have a great rest of your week.
Brad, thank you so much, and I must commend you and the HCP team for putting together Derm Discussions. I think this is a great medium in this virtual pandemic we're living in to still stay connected. I think all of us have virtual fatigue, but sometimes at least just hearing everyone's voice and hearing an interesting topic and two friends talking can hopefully invigorate and energize us. So I know I feel energized after talking with you, and thanks for all your hard work in putting this together.
Thank you so much, Samal. Have a great evening.
You as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Desai, for your time and invaluable insight. And thank you, the listener, for listening. To keep up with Derm Discussions and all things clinical news, check us out at hcplive.com. And make sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and Spotify. Also, you can follow HCP Live on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Stay tuned for more Derm Discussions with Dr. Glick next month.